Hello and welcome to our digestion segment on the endocrinology of appetite. You know, it's interesting when we look at all this and we look at the digestive tract, it's taught a lot from the perspective of the anatomy and what are all the parts and the physiology and how things go through and the enzymes, but very few people talk a lot about the endocrinology, all the hormones. And there are more hormones that run digestion and appetite than there are ones that are in our set glands, like the adrenals and the thyroid and the reproductive glands. And so I think it's a very overlooked topic of conversation. So by the end of this presentation, we're going to be doing the endocrinology of appetite, and our next presentation will be on the endocrinology of digestion. But you're going to learn a lot about the hormonal control of appetite and satiation behaviors. And I'm sure that you either have dealt with or are going to deal with clients who, no matter what they're doing, they just don't seem to be able to lose the weight, and they have this huge appetite and their metabolic rate seems to have slowed down to a standstill. So hopefully by the end of this presentation, you'll have a clearer idea of how appetite is controlled hormonally. And when I say hormonally, I'm using that loosely to mean neuroendocrine. So it's really a combination of neurons and hormones that make like the neuroendocrinology of the digestive tract and of appetite. So just know that some of them are pure hormones and they're ones that we've heard about and talked about before, and others are actually neuropeptides, neurohormones. So before we get into the bulk of our presentation, I just want you to be clear that all the information that I'm sharing is not intended to replace your one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. And when you're teaching this kind of information to your clients, you want to make sure that they're clear that you're not diagnosing, you're not treating, you're just looking and making an educated assessment or guess as to where they're at and then helping them by educating them. There's a lot to be learned here, and so take your time and make sure that you take really good notes. And this is probably a presentation you're going to want to listen to several times to really grasp it all. So the overall control of appetite is by several different places. One is in certain brain centers. Another is by neuropeptides. Proteins, like they're like neurotransmitters, but not exactly. We like to call them neurohormones as well. Insulin, which is a big key player. Adipose hormones, and there's several we're going to look at. Hormones that are actually produced in the fat tissue. Most people don't think about fat cells as being hormonal glands or endocrine glands, but they are. And then other hormones that play into this. So I'm going to go through in as much detail as I feel warranted. Certain hormones will go into more than others. So let's take a look at the brain centers. Now, there's a lot of research on these centers. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the particular areas of the brain. We'll go through a lot more of this when we actually do a nervous system brain module. But these are the areas that control the appetite, and there's a lot of research and a lot of textbooks where you can look, and there's actually a whole textbook on the endocrinology of appetite. So the hypothalamus, right? We think about the hypothalamus as our master control center. It helps us regulate body temperature, blood pressure, thyroid output via the metabolism via thyroid output, our stress response, and also appetite. The hypothalamus receives signals from other parts of the body and from hormones secreted by other parts of the body that either tell it full or empty. Where is the gas gauge? Full or empty? And then it does its part to stimulate feeding type behaviors and hunger as a process. So things like leptin we'll talk about, and a couple of neuropeptides, and insulin, and glucagon, all of those things have receptors in the hypothalamus that help to control appetite. There's also some areas in the brainstem, the back part of the brain, right, at the very back, that help control appetite. In particular, there's a place called the nucleus accumbens, and that has a big role in controlling appetite. the ventral pallidum, and something called the mesolimbic dopamine system. And then there are other centers in the brain called reward centers. And these are where a lot of the appetite control happens. We're going to focus on the hormonal control of appetite and the interaction between the hormones and the neuropeptides. So let's take a look and an overview of what these peptides are, and then we'll go into detail about these later in the presentation. So these neuropeptides regulate the energy homeostasis. They regulate how hungry we are based on the signal that it's coming from various places that say empty or full. So the places that send the signal up to the brain to produce these or produce these hormones are adipose tissue, the fat cells. Fat cells produce leptin and a couple of others that we'll talk about in a bit. The pancreas, which produces insulin and its counterpart glucagon. And then the stomach, which produces ghrelin. And so these are main places where there's signals coming. The neuropeptides that then regulate are neuropeptide Y, leptin, orexin A and orexin B. You might also see them called hypocretin 1 and 2. The next slide is a very kind of complex looking picture, and it basically shows on the left side those hormones that actually increase their stimulatory peptides. And they're on the left-hand side, and then on the right side are inhibitory. So everything on the left-hand side will stimulate appetite, and everything on the right-hand side will depress appetite. At first glance, though, we think about that as being, well, everything that stimulates appetite, oh, we want to watch out for those because those are quote-unquote bad because they're going to make a person want to eat more. In reality, a lot of them have very good properties. And in particular, we're going to look at a couple of those in a little bit. But they're not necessarily bad. They just stimulate appetite. But while they're stimulating appetite, several of them actually stimulate fat burning and utilization as well. So this is just an overview. It's from a book called Appetite and Body Weight. I found it online as a Google book. And I was able to scan through this book. I was going to buy a copy of it on Amazon, and it was $150. So I thought, I'm happy to just scan it on Google. Lots of great information. If you just put that into your Google search bar, Appetite and Body Weight by Tim Kirkham, you'll find a link to it, and it's got some really fascinating information in there. The original intent of the book was to explore drugs, medications that control appetite, but we find our best information when we're looking at the actual drug research because it gives us really detailed biochemistry. So let's have a look at some of the hormones, and we're going to look at these in a little more detail. So the hormones that control appetite, insulin and glucagon, right? Insulin gets secreted when there is sugar getting into the bloodstream, and insulin actually will turn off the appetite while it's processing. Glucagon can control it by turning it on because glucagon goes when the blood sugar gets low and we want to eat. By the way, those two are secreted by the pancreas, just as a reminder. Leptin secreted by fat cells, adipose tissue, to say, hey, we're full, you know, no worries. And leptin is a confusing hormone. We'll go into more detail on it, but it confuses people because it's desired to have higher levels of leptin so that the appetite gets turned off. But on the other hand, fat people say, well, why am I hungry all the time? I have plenty of fat cells. Am I not producing enough leptin to turn it off? Well, we have this problem that happens with a lot of hormones, good old hormone resistance. So people who have excessive amount of adipose tissue will end up with leptin resistance. And then the hypothalamus will see leptin and go, oh yeah, I'm just calling your bluff. You know, you're just the boy who cried wolf. So it gets resistant. Ghrelin is secreted by the lining of the stomach when it's empty. And the name ghrelin actually came from growling. And growling is basically how your stomach feels when it's empty. It starts to growl. So that empty feeling in the stomach when your stomach starts to growl is secreting ghrelin, which stimulates appetite. But like everything is a double-edged sword. Ghrelin, while it's stimulating appetite, is also stimulating growth hormone, because we know that growth hormone can stimulate fat burning. So, you know, it's like, oh, you have to balance it out between that hunger and that uncomfortable feeling that people get with hunger, but also some of the positive things that happen. So I always tell people, well, when you start to get hungry, see if you can wait a half an hour. Take some water to try to calm things down. Just make sure that it's true hunger. But even if you could sit with hunger for a half an hour, it gives you a half an hour of allowing growth hormone to build up in the system and burn fat. Now, that's good for people who are overweight. But for people who are underweight, they probably don't want to do that. And that we get into a whole other mechanism with that. There are other hormones synthesized by the adipose tissue, and we'll go into them. And then there's a whole bunch of them synthesized by the gut. And these all have control on the appetite. So these hormones reflect the long-term nutritional status of the body, and they're able to influence neural circuits that then control feeding behaviors. So it's kind of interesting. So when you're working with somebody who's hungry all the time, it really helps to get to the heart of it. There are a lot of things that affect hunger besides food and besides the macronutrients that are coming in. One of them is sleep. And I don't know if you've ever noticed it, but I sure have, is when I'm sleep deprived, I'm ravenously hungry. It's all I could do is think about food the next day. So if you can't get your clients to get sleep for the other health benefits of it, if they're tired of being overweight and tired of overeating, you can explain to them how when they don't get enough sleep, it triggers more hunger. These are just some of the areas in the body that have an effect on appetite and whether they have a positive or negative. So adipose tissue produces leptin and also adiponectin, which we'll talk about later. And leptin decreases appetite, so that's the red arrow. Adiponectin actually increases appetite, and that would be a green arrow, but it's not on this picture. Adrenals produce glucocorticoids, so cortisol and norepinephrine. Cortisone has an influential increase in the appetite, whereas epinephrine can go either way. It just depends. Ghrelin increases appetite from the stomach. Actually, even estrogen produced by the testicles in males and the ovaries in females can have a decrease in appetite. And then the hypothalamus, which produces a whole bunch of stuff, including neuropeptide Y and somatoliberin, and those both increase the appetite. So again, you're not going to memorize these things, but you are going to be working with people where it's confusing as to why they have an increased appetite and how you can help them to control their appetite. And if you start to do research, you'll start to see these things. It also helps to be able to think through the process. It's not just a matter of them overeating and getting overweight or not sleeping. It's a matter of hormonal balance. So let's take a closer look at some of the appetite hormones, and then a few of these we're going to go into a lot more detail. There's one called amylin, and that gets secreted by the pancreas. And what it does is it delays the gastric emptying, which means that it allows that the stomach, the contents of the stomach, do not empty into the small intestine, and it lowers blood glucose. Now, the reason that it's doing that is to prevent the glucose from going too high. So it lowers the glucose and also delays the food in the stomach from getting down into the intestines so that the sugars can be absorbed. Another hormone that we're going to go into a lot more detail about in our digestion endocrinology module is CCK, also known as cholecystokinin. And what you can see is cholecyst, that's related to gallbladder. Cholecalciferol, it's a fat. But we have cholecystitis. There's a whole bunch of different things with that, the beginning. So cholecystokinin, it suppresses hunger and signals satiety. It inhibits the emptying of the stomach. And it stimulates gallbladder secretion. Influences something called peptide YY, which we'll talk about in our digestion endocrinology section. And it's stimulated by fat and protein. So it's stimulated by fat and protein in the duodenum. It's secreted by the duodenum. And then it stimulates the secretion of gallbladder, so the contraction and the release of the bile, so that it can absorb the fat. And we'll go into more detail about that. It has a few other things that it does. But right now, for the appetite, what it does is suppresses hunger and signals, hey, okay, we're good, we're full. CRF, which is corticotropin-releasing factor, right? That's what happens in the hypothalamus under stress to stimulate the ACTH from the pituitary, which then stimulates the release of adrenaline and cortisol from the adrenals. That has an effect of reducing appetite. Why? Well, because if you're running away from a tiger, it ain't so good to be hungry. So that's a stress response. And we'll look at later how the stress actually responds from a hormonal and biochemical standpoint, how that actually impacts the digestion. Dopamine, you've heard of dopamine. It's a very popular neurotransmitter. Decrease in dopamine can lead to depression and can lead to apathy so much. People just don't love what they're doing anymore. But dopamine itself reinforces pleasure from food and contributes to cravings. So if people have too much dopamine, which can happen sometimes when they have specific SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms on the genetic side, that cause the decrease in the breakdown of dopamine. In particular, one that I can think of is COMT, catecholamine O-methyltransferase. So too much dopamine building up because it's not being broken down actually contributes to food cravings. And one of the things, and just as an aside, marijuana, people talk about when they smoke marijuana, they get the cravings, the munchies. It's because marijuana has the ability to increase the level of dopamine in the body, and that increases the cravings. Ghrelin, like I said before, is secreted by the stomach, and it triggers hunger. It's like, okay, we're empty, we need more. It increases the preference for fatty and sweet foods. It's like, oh, we're really hungry now. So somebody's been on a fast or has gone too long, then they start to crave that fatty and sweet foods. So whereas I said earlier, it's a good idea to allow the ghrelin, you know, to do its thing and stimulate growth hormone for half an hour or so. If you go too long, the person is going to start having really severe cravings for fatty and sweet foods. It increases the gastric motility, which is why that growling that happens in between meals. So those are some of the appetite. Let's look at more appetite hormones. These, again, some of these are, we're going to go into a lot more detail when we do our digestion hormones. But GIP, it used to be called gastric inhibitory protein. It's now called glucose-dependent insulinotrophic polypeptide. So GIP actually stimulates the insulin release while a person's still eating. So it's starting to stimulate the insulin to get ready for the sugar to be absorbed. Doesn't even have to wait for it to fully be absorbed. Diabetics actually become resistant to GIP. When we look at the digestion hormones, we'll look at the influence that GIP has on the digestion. Right now we're just looking at appetite. GLP is something that is called glucagon-like peptide. Remember, glucagon is secreted by the pancreas when the blood sugar gets low. GLP actually slows gastric emptying, promotes insulin release, and inhibits glucagon, and suppresses appetite. Glucagon increases satiety, suppresses appetite. Insulin lowers the blood glucose and stimulates glycogen storage and fat synthesis as storage. Okay, so it would be secreted by the pancreas, of course. Leptin decreases food intake, regulates metabolism. It gives the signal to the brain that says, okay, we're good, we got enough, we're good, and secreted by the fat cells. Adiponectin is also secreted by the fat cells, and we'll look at that in a lot more detail later in the presentation, but it enhances fatty acid oxidation, reduces triglycerides, stimulates blood glucose uptake, inhibits glucose production, decreases glucose levels, and stimulates appetite. So we're going to see some really positive things that adiponectin does in a little bit. NPY, neuropeptide Y, stimulates appetite. There's another one called oxyntomodulin. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, but oxyntomodulin, I've never heard it said before. I always see it written. Inhibits ghrelin. which means that what? It depresses appetite, right? Because ghrelin stimulates it. So it inhibits the ghrelin, and it's secreted once the food hits the stomach, so we don't need the ghrelin anymore. And it slows the gastric emptying to allow the churning to happen and the digestion of proteins to begin. So it stimulates insulin release if you've eaten carbohydrate. We've also got PP, pancreatic polypeptide, which slows the gastric emptying and inhibits the appetite. PYY, peptide YY, slows the gastric emptying, suppresses appetite, stimulates satiety, and the highest levels have been detected about 90 minutes after starting a meal. So it's like, So sometimes people don't get satisfied right away while they're eating. They eat and then they overeat and they realize half an hour, 45 minutes later that they're stuffed. So peptide YY comes in a little bit later. And again, you're not going to need to memorize all this. You've got this. You're going to become familiar with this. You can look things up when you're dealing with a case that's confusing. Serotonin is a common neurotransmitter, and lack of it leads to depression and OCD and anxiety. It also has a link with providing that calm feeling after eating sugar. And when it's decreased, it's linked to carbohydrate cravings. So serotonin deficiency leads to that craving for carbohydrates that people get. So the last of these are not actually considered digestive hormones or appetite-related hormones in general, but they have an influence on it. So melatonin, sleep deprivation decreases it, which decreases leptin and increases ghrelin, which, guess what? Increases appetite. So this is why when people don't get enough sleep, in particular, I've noticed that very much so, is that you don't get enough sleep, you're starving the next day. Sex hormones, like estrogen, suppresses appetite. An imbalance between estrogen and progesterone can trigger intense food cravings. And this is what happens to a lot of women right before their menses when they have their PMS going on, right, is that there is an imbalance. If they have too much estrogen compared to progesterone, or even vice versa, it can trigger intense food cravings. And in particular, women tend to crave chocolate. And my theory behind that is that chocolate's a good source of magnesium, and magnesium needs increase right before the period to help to get rid of the extra hormones that are being released as the levels drop down in the blood. So cortisol is responsible for increasing your response or being able to respond to stress. And if the levels stay high for a long period of time, it actually leads to intense cravings and binge eating, because it actually stimulates the breakdown of sugars from protein to bring the sugars up, and then it triggers more insulin, which can lead to hyperinsulinemia and insulin resistance. So not a good situation. So let's take a look at some of these a little bit more closely. Let's take a look at the overall appetite regulation. We've got fat cells producing leptin, which increase the satiety if it goes through the hypothalamus and increases satiety. We've got the leptin, when the leptin goes down, it will increase hunger. The gut produces ghrelin, which stimulates PYY, peptide YY, which will then increase the hunger. And then as ghrelin is secreted by the stomach, it goes down, then it stimulates the satiety. So in summary, again, fat cells, when they get nice and fat and happy after you've had a big meal and you can't use all that energy and it gets stored in fat, the fat cells plump up, they send a signal, hey, we're good, we're full. That sends a signal of satiety. When the leptin levels go down, it sends a signal of hunger. When the gut produces polypeptide YY, that stops the hunger. And when the stomach produces ghrelin, or stops producing ghrelin, that increases its satiety. So basically, we've got this constant, like the hypothalamus is going, okay, what's out there? What do I need to do? How do I control this? What levels of ghrelin are there? How much polypeptide YY is there? How much adiponectin? So it's constantly reading and then either sending the signal, eat or stop eating. So it's a rather complicated and sophisticated, but quite beautiful mechanism. So let's take a little bit closer look at some of the key players in appetite. Leptin wasn't even discovered until the 1990s. We didn't even know it existed. And who knows what other hormones are going to be discovered as science progresses and starts to do more studying. This whole science of appetite is actually quite a big business. And there's a lot of research going on in it. So leptin, like I said, secretes by the fat cells, the white adipose tissue, signals the hypothalamus and the pancreas that we're full, which means that the hypothalamus is going to stop the hunger desire, the desire to eat, and the pancreas is going to reduce the level of the secretion of insulin. The hypothalamus response turns off the appetite. The pancreas stops producing insulin. But the thing is, both of these places, the hypothalamus and the pancreas, become resistant to leptin. I'm sure you've heard the term leptin resistance. Leptin, in addition to being triggered by the fat cells changing size, either increasing or decreasing, has a 24-hour circadian rhythm that's controlled by eating. Leptin levels actually get really high. They're supposed to peak within a few hours after eating dinner, and they start to come down, and they're at their lowest level in the morning. So let's take a look at some pictures of what happens and what that's supposed to look like. This is normal leptin function. So if we look at the very start on the left-hand side, that's 6 p.m., that's dinner time. If leptin is perceived properly, we're not going to be hungry after dinner. We're going to be nice and satiated, right? Everything's fine. Everything's good. Usually peaks somewhere around midnight and then starts to come down. Well, the fat burning begins when it peaks, or the intensity of the fat burning. It increases by 40% and it goes all the way up to 60%. So this period of time from about midnight to 8 a.m., the body's supposed to be in prime fat burning. What happens when we throw this off, we'll see on the next picture. And we can throw this off by the patterns that people are eating and when they're eating certain foods. Okay? So leptin normally peaks at midnight, starts to come down, is back down at 8 a.m. to the same level it started at his dinner time, and then goes back through the day. Leptin resistance, however, when you have carbohydrates too early in the day, when your client eats their pancake breakfast or their Cap'n Crunch with sugar on top or their orange juice, and even for some people, high sugar fruits, it causes the leptin to peak too soon. It causes the leptin to peak earlier on, before midnight, so that it's starting to come down while you're still awake. See, when leptin's starting to come down in the middle of the night, we're asleep. We don't care. But if you stay up too late, the leptin starts to come down. That's when you get the munchies at midnight and you're looking for food to eat. But if you eat carbs too early in the day, that peak might happen at 10 o'clock, which means that right around the time you're ready to go to bed, you're starting to feel hungry. And if you give in to that, you're going to throw off all the fat burning that can normally happen throughout the night. So this, when leptin is resistant, when the cells become resistant to leptin, the cell, we don't get that signal. The hypothalamus doesn't read it properly and say, oh, we're full. And then we get intense food cravings. So it's really important to be teaching people not to have that big carbohydrate breakfast. So let's look at a few of the guidelines for eating to control leptin. So the things that disrupt leptin signaling, one, a high carbohydrate meal in the morning. You know, that good old house of pancakes breakfast with the fruit and the syrup on top? Bad news for leptin. Causes you to peak too early, causes the cravings in the evening, causes people to eat too much in the evening, put on extra weight, and maintain insulin resistance. Eating too frequently can also disrupt leptin. We need to be ideally for leptin 4 to 6 hours between meals. Insufficient sleep, because we don't allow that leptin signal, you know, that peak at midnight and then that optimal fat burning to happen in the middle of the night, and that causes intense food cravings the next day. Insulin resistance can cause leptin problems. Insulin resistance causes the sugars to stay higher in the blood longer, which doesn't trigger the release of leptin. There are a couple of fungicides, tolylfluinid, and other endocrine disruptors. So these kind of things can disrupt the signaling, can create a leptin resistance and all. And BPA, bisphenol A, which is found in a lot of the plastics. So this becomes another reason for you to teach people not to heat things in plastic, not to drink out of water bottles that have been sitting in the hot car and releasing the BPA into the water itself. The reason for choosing to use glass containers to store and then reheat their leftover foods. So let's look at a few things that increase leptin and decrease leptin. So things that increase would be insulin, cortisone, and estrogens. And cortisone is the storage form of cortisol. Things that decrease are adrenaline, male hormones, and growth hormone. So there's a lot of ways to affect it, and the timing is really, really important. So this is how your clients can control. Avoid eating after dinner so that we don't have another spike after dinner. We want to allow the leptin to peak at midnight. Stick to 3 meals a day. Avoid snacking. You know, of course, you're going to find situations where there's an exception to that. Someone who's extremely thin and tends to need to eat very frequently with a high metabolism, so you have to, that's fine. But for the most part, most people are not in that situation. You want to allow 5 to 6 hours between meals. There's a lot of good reasons for allowing 5 to 6 hours between meals besides leptin as well, and we'll look at that a little bit more when we do the digestion endocrinology. Avoiding overly large meals, eating slowly, having breakfast that contains protein and very little in the way of carbohydrates, and then overall, people can reduce their intake of starchy carbs. There's a really good book called Mastering Leptin by Byron Richards. Very, very good book, 400 and some pages with lots of references if you want to go deeper with leptin. So let's look at the meal timing. I mean, it's really reinforcing this, is the prolonged insulin curve or more frequent insulin spikes plus decreased leptin promote obesity. This is a reason to decrease snacking. When they work with mice and they feed them frequently, they end up with leptin resistance and they end up pretty darn chubby. So maintaining ideal body weight is critical as well, because the obesity increases insulin resistance, which affects the leptin resistance as well. Avoiding eating late at night, because that causes insulin and decreases the growth hormone and leptin, so you decrease that burning overnight. Avoiding, like I said earlier, the high carbohydrate breakfast. The morning carb overdoses cause the premature spike. So the leptin is going to spike somewhere around 10 and it starts to come down, and that interrupts that optimal fat burning during the night. That's it on leptin. Let's take a quick look at ghrelin before we go into a few other of the lesser known hormones. So ghrelin is secreted by the cells in the stomach wall. When you eat, it suppresses ghrelin. When you're hungry between meals, it secretes ghrelin. Ghrelin stimulates appetite. Ghrelin causes your stomach to growl. But ghrelin is also a potent stimulator of growth hormone. So again, it's that double-edged sword. So I tell people to wait until the stomach's empty and you're hungry. Not just that little hungry, but fairly hungry. Not I'm going to kill somebody to eat hungry, but fairly hungry. That's going to help to stimulate some fat burning and muscle sparing via growth hormone in between meals. Now, you have to find this out for each person, whether they can do this and what the balance is. So let's take a look at a few other hormones that may or may not have heard about. There's one called resistin, and there's a link there to an article that talks about resistin roles. It's a peptide that's secreted by fat cells. So far we've learned about leptin gets secreted by fat cells, adiponectin, and resistin. It was discovered quite recently in the 1990s, similarly to how leptin was first discovered. It's named for its ability to resist insulin. So resistin actually contributes to, guess what? Insulin resistance. So it's linked to diabetes and obesity as well. It's also known as adipose tissue specific secretory factor. It's rich in the amino acid cysteine, and it's a peptide hormone, and this is the gene. So if you've gotten your genes done or you have a client's gene done, you can look to see if that gene is activated for them or is a possibility for them to have a problem with. So resistin actually increases the insulin resistance and the increase in the belly fat that we get with insulin resistance. And those extra fat cells then secrete leptin, which seems like it would be a good thing, but then that creates leptin resistance, which is a bad thing. Let's look at orexin. Orexin's a neuropeptide. It's released by the hypothalamus. It's linked to wakefulness and sleep, appetite regulation, and the motivation of sexual and addictive behaviors. I've seen it mentioned as a hormone in the brain that has the effects of adrenaline and testosterone all at once. Increases your sex drive and increases that hyper alertness that adrenaline does. Basically, it's the hormone, neuropeptide, whatever you want to call it, that promotes people to continue to eat, to continue to be hungry and have an appetite, even when they're full. So if ever you've sat down to a meal and you just keep eating, orexin can be the cause. And there's two different variations that have been identified, and there's a lot of research on it if you want to go look it up and go deeper with it. Neuropeptide Y is the most abundant neuropeptide in the brain, and it has a stronger effect at appetite stimulation than even ghrelin has. It's so strong that when they give rats an injection of neuropeptide Y, they crave sugar over sex, and that says a lot for our poor little rats. The primary trigger for neuropeptide Y is low leptin and calorie restriction. Okay, so it's going to really be a potent stimulator of appetite because the leptin's low, signaling that, hey, we don't have any reserves and we don't have any calories coming in. So therefore, neuropeptide Y to the rescue. But it's really hard because its primary job is actually to delay the feeling of fullness so that you can overeat. It's like if you're starving, you don't want to just eat that 500 calorie meal to make it up. If you have access to food, you want to be able to eat more in times of starvation. And so that's where this hormone comes into play. It tells the body where and how to store extra calories as either fat or muscle, and it prefers fat. So high levels of neuropeptide Y will cause less fullness, and the calories will be stored as fat. Not friendly, huh? It has a point. It has a point for survival, but it's not something that we want a lot of in our overweight patients that we're trying to help to drop some extra weight. So what does neuropeptide Y interact with? Well, leptin will inhibit neuropeptide Y because why? There's plenty to eat, right? Just eat your fat cells. The hypothalamic neuropeptide Y stimulates insulin secretion and cortisol and shifts metabolism to favor fat. It's our starvation hormone. It's what we need when we're in starvation mode and you just start going across the desert and haven't eaten for 4 days and now you see a big old apple tree there. You want to be able to store it away and save it as fat for the next rainy day. So weight loss restriction, so calorie restriction, when people are on these yo-yo diets, they've got this neuropeptide Y release from the periventricular nucleus. And what happens is it becomes this really difficult cycle of starve, binge, starve, binge. And it's neurochemically, neurohormonally controlled. Let's talk about adiponectin. I have become fond of adiponectin as I've done my research. It's 244 amino acids long, so it's a big polypeptide. It's produced by the adipose tissue, so we know that from the adipo. It increases the metabolic rate. Yay, that's good for people who are overweight. It plays an important role in the energetic capacity of skeletal muscle, so it makes the skeletal muscle use more energy. So it makes the skeletal muscles much more able to do work. It counteracts inflammation and insulin resistance. Now, we really like that, right? And I'll show you a study in rats that shows how they determine that. Super important for weight loss. So much so that there is actually research going on how do we give people adiponectin. But I'm going to share with you some diet and lifestyle things that can help to increase it. It increases insulin sensitivity, yay, and affects insulin levels. So for our insulin resistant clients and patients, we would want to be able to do things to help them stimulate adiponectin, as long as those things that are going to stimulate adiponectin are not going to be hurting them in other ways. We always have to look at the double-edged sword, by the way, because sometimes there are things that help one part of the body and hurt other parts of the body. And it's the concept of robbing Peter to pay Paul. So we have to make sure that the decisions that we help people to make are helpful for everything in the body. And sometimes there's choices that have to be made. And with adiponectin, that certainly is the case. When there's a deficiency of adiponectin, it's very hard to get rid of fat and stay thin. So these people that you're working with that are like, I can't seem to lose weight no matter what I do, it's possible that their adiponectin is low. Now, I don't know of ways to measure these that are commercially available. Maybe that's something that research will give us and uncover as time goes on. Adiponectin can help to stimulate weight loss without increasing appetite. And that's a good thing, because a lot of the other hormones that will help with weight loss will actually stimulate appetite. So say ghrelin, we don't want to give somebody ghrelin because it stimulates growth hormone and helps them to burn fat, because then they're in this discomfort state of being hungry. With adiponectin, it's not like that. There's receptors in the hypothalamus, and there are some forms of adiponectin that have been found in the cerebrospinal fluid. Adiponectin can enhance the oxidation of fatty acids in muscles and livers, which means it can break down the triglycerides and decrease the triglyceride levels in these places. It stimulates the uptake of glucose by skeletal and cardiac muscle, which means, wow, okay, our skeletal muscles are going to be able to do more and burn more energy. And the cardiac muscle is going to be more efficient if it has the ability to take in the glucose. And which basically means that it's the opposite of insulin resistance, right? If we can take in more glucose into the cells and utilize that, that's what we're looking for when we're looking to help reverse insulin resistance. And it inhibits glucose production by the liver. It inhibits the process called gluconeogenesis, which is the breakdown of glycogen to form more glucose. So overall, we like adiponectin so far, right? It decreases blood glucose levels. And it's needed to turn fat into energy. It helps the body use the fat to fuel the muscle. So adiponectin has great promise for us in helping people. So what do we do to control it? Well, they found in studies that daily fish oil or other omega-3 supplementation increased adiponectin levels by 14 to 60%. That can be helpful. Weight loss with low-calorie diet with exercise added to it, not just these binge eat cycles that people get into, these crazy starvation diets, but weight loss with a low-calorie diet with exercise increased adiponectin levels on the average 18 to 48%. And fiber supplementation, which, you know, we don't necessarily need fiber supplementation as much as high-fiber foods, 60 to 115% increase in adiponectin levels. So when we hear of people who change their diets and they dramatically lose weight when they first change their diets, and they're, you know, eating a little bit less, or eating a lot more high fiber foods, decreasing the carbohydrates, they're getting response and their adiponectin levels are responding by going up. The high carbohydrate meals are associated with lower adiponectin. So that pancake breakfast that's not good for leptin, also not good for adiponectin levels. They also found that extracts of sweet potatoes have been reported to increase adiponectin, but they weren't, the research wasn't conclusive enough to say, you know, great for people with diabetes to actually start eating a lot more sweet potatoes. I think the jury's out on that. But there was definitely extracts of sweet potatoes. And I've got some of these studies that you can see at the end of the presentation. Some other things that affect adiponectin. Magnesium increases adiponectin. And we know that so many of our clients are deficient in magnesium. They're not eating enough magnesium-rich foods, except for their chocolate, their sweetened chocolate. But we need to get them eating more greens and more magnesium-rich foods and taking magnesium supplements and doing topical magnesium and magnesium baths. And that can actually help them with their weight by increasing adipoleptin. Coffee is actually associated with high adiponectin and low leptin. So, you know, some people do respond well to coffee, but here's one of those double-edged swords. Coffee can also, the caffeine can be overstimulating to the adrenals. It can also be damaging to the gut lining. Caffeine actually thins the lining of the gut mucosal membrane. Moderate alcohol intake was associated with higher adiponectin concentrations. Again, I'm not advocating that we do this, but this is something that, you know, its research is showing, but there's downsides of the alcohol, right? Alcohol feeds candida overgrowth. Alcohol stresses the liver. Alcohol actually damages brain cells. Intermittent fasting can increase adiponectin levels. Prolonged fasting, not necessarily, but intermittent fasting, and that's why I think part of why so many people get great results with intermittent fasting. Some people do intermittent fasting where they go a whole 24-hour period every 2 days, right? So or twice a week or once a week even, and they just don't eat anything for those 24 hours. Or other people do intermittent fasting where they don't start eating until like 2 p.m. and they eat until 6, and then they have this long gap of 20 hours between meals. So there's a number of ways to do intermittent fasting, as long as it's not done too frequently or too severely, in which case it would turn down the metabolism, could actually increase the adiponectin levels. Sleep, yay! The other way that sleep helps is that it increases adiponectin levels. So when we don't get enough sleep, we increase ghrelin and decrease leptin, but we get plenty of sleep, we can increase our adiponectin, which can be really good. There have been some experiments with a couple of Ayurvedic herbs. One is piperbetel and dolichos biflorus. So I haven't looked at those herbs. I haven't ever used those herbs, but this was in a research study that I found. So I thought I would share that with you if you want to start looking at that. You know, in your resistant fat loss people, having an Ayurvedic combination could be helpful. So here's, in a nutshell, here's an overview. We've got down at the bottom, fasting state. Fasting causes the fat to start burning itself, which increases the level of adiponectin. The adiponectin gets into the cerebral spinal fluid, gets up into the brain, increases AMPK, which then has all these wonderful effects that we just talked about. But the downside is it also stimulates NPY, neuropeptide Y, which we said is a potent appetite increaser. Okay, so indirectly the adiponectin can increase the appetite, but it also does all this other stuff while it's doing that. Okay, good picture. Last one, let's look at a couple more on adiponectin. The study in mice found that when they were given TNF-alpha, which is a potent inflammatory cytokine, that the injections with adiponectin reverse the effects of the cytokines and decrease the inflammation. So it could be good for people who have inflammation and, you know, especially insulin resistance. So working with them to help them increase their adiponectin level through those lifestyle and diet things we talked about. Other really good effects in summary of adiponectin, it decreases gluconeogenesis, which is the breakdown of sugar from glycogen stores, increases the uptake of glucose, increases beta oxidation of fats, which then increases triglyceride clearance, breaks them down and clears them. Protects from endothelial dysfunction, protects the delicate lining of the blood vessels from damage, improves the sensitivity of insulin, the cell sensitivity, and therefore promotes weight loss, reduces TNF-alpha, and controls the metabolism of energy. So overall, positive results from adiponectin. So the lower levels are associated with ADHD. So that's an interesting one to note. So when kids are put on Ritalin, they may have low adiponectin levels. And interestingly enough, we see that a lot of kids who are diagnosed with ADD, not all of them, have some issues with their weight. It's increased in rheumatoid arthritis. That's interesting. And then exercise-induced release of adiponectin increased hippocampal growth and led to antidepressive symptoms in mice. So when we increase the adiponectin, we get less depression. So better focus and less depression. And lastly, a couple of studies that were done with adiponectin, and they've got a whole bunch of resources that you can look at. There was a 10-week study with 17 healthy subjects. They increased omega-3 intake and decreased omega-6 intake. And the result was that there were significant reductions in TNF-alpha and low-density lipoprotein cholesterol along with increased adiponectin. So that sounds good. So that's a study reinforcing about the omega-3s. And then there's a study on adiponectin as a marker for metabolic syndrome. And so as the adiponectin levels go up, metabolic syndrome rates go down. And we can actually use it. So I haven't looked to see what's available commercially in terms of measuring adiponectin levels. That would be a good thing to do. But these research papers are rather recent. Okay, so the next two pages, I've got a whole bunch of resources and references that you can go to, and they're good stuff if you want to really dig into this and make this a specialty. So I hope that this was really helpful for you so you have a little better understanding of how appetite is controlled by neuropeptides and hormones, and we'll see you on the next video.